all the congregation of the people of Israel moved on from the wilderness of Sin by stages, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Okay, now, we have arrived, or we are making our way, to the wilderness of Sin. They have made it to Rephidim. And now that they're here, they're in another place, of course, where there's no water. And so they are once again being tested by God in a desolate place where they would have to trust in God for their very survival again. And so they come. Now, I wanted you to notice this. The reason I asked this first question is because I really wanted you to notice where they are. They have moved on, and they're moving, according to this, in stages. Okay, so they're moving step by step into this place, is what that phrase implies, that they're not just taking a straight beeline from wherever they left Egypt to wherever they're supposed to arrive at Sinai. They're moving along in stages, and this is precisely how God intended for them to travel. Plus the fact that, as we saw before, that he is forcing them into situations where they have to rely on him for their livelihood. They have to continue to trust him as they go from one place to another. And once again, how do they respond? Well, exactly the way they always do. They start whining again and start complaining about their situation. Now, what I find ironical here is here they get to a place where there's no water, and yet this is a place where they go out every morning and collect manna. Okay? So they're going out every morning to collect the food that God has said they're going to have, and what happens? They get to a place where there's no water, and instead of going, okay, we'll just assume God's going to give us water here, what do? They start to just complain and whine and blah, blah, blah. Okay.
Manna is something they've never seen before come up.
Yeah, but it's there every day, except Sunday.
Yeah.
You know, in some sort of bizarre way, it's not there one day of the week. And yet it's there every day. And then on Saturday, or Sunday, well, let me rephrase. It's not there on Saturday. Thank you for correcting my error. It's not there on Saturday. But on Friday, there's twice as much available for them to take for 2 days. And it doesn't spoil overnight like it. So they have all these, you know, daily miracles taking place. And they get to one place where there's water. And once again, what do? They start.
If they meant they got it double Friday, Saturday, so they didn't have nothing to eat that.
They got it double on Friday, so they had to eat it on Saturday.
Saturday.
Saturday. Right. The last day of the week would be Sabbath for these people. Yeah. So once again, they blame Moses for bringing them up out of Egypt, as though Moses' words had been sufficient to make Pharaoh change his mind and release the Hebrews. As though Moses was the one that is able to accomplish this. Why is it that human beings are so blind to the power of God, even when the power of God is right in front of them? Now, let's not throw a stone because we live in glass houses, so, you know, obviously. But that's what happens, right? 400 years of living without any direct word from God has blinded them to his power to the point where when they get out and actually see it, they can't remember it for 24 hours. So God comes to Moses and says in verse 5, pass on before the people, taking with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. I don't want you to miss that connection, by the way. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and the water shall come out, and the people will drink. Okay, so notice the connection. And it's specific in the text that it says, God says, take the rock, take the staff that you struck the Nile with, and now go strike a rock. Okay. Notice the dichotomy, right? Strike the waters of the Nile, which was life-giving water to begin with, and it becomes poisonous, and it's not able to provide life. Now he's to come and hit a rock with the stick, and it will produce water that will be sufficient for the people to do this. So that's God's sort of little jest, if you will, of saying, okay, this staff that you have, it's capable of poisoning water, but it's also capable of bringing forth great water, so I want you to use it. And by the way, that's my power, not yours, and it's not the staff, it's me, okay? And he also says, and I will stand before you on the rock. And I had you notice that because, you know, it's the idea that God standing above this is obviously God is not physically standing on a rock. It's, you know, a metaphor. Just as God speaking is a metaphor, you know, unless we're talking about Jesus speaking, but if it's God speaking as a spirit, it's a metaphor. He doesn't have lips and a tongue and lungs to make, you know, a voice box to make sounds with. He speaks in a different way. God stood before them, meaning he's present there. He's present everywhere, but he's being present in a specific kind of way. My power is going to come at this particular moment. So Moses, you go and stand in front of these people. By the way, go take some of the elders with you, okay? What's the point of that? Why? Why would Moses be instructed to bring elders along? The answer is this: become the witnesses. They will go back to their tribes and say, this is what God has done. They're supposed to be the ones, you remember, according to the previous chapter, or previous chapters, I'm sorry, in the next chapter, that, I get these mixed up, that they're going to be the ones eventually who are going to be doing the judging of Israel. They're going to be the ones who are going to be helping Moses deal with the issues that he had. Okay, we'll come to that in a minute. And so they're going to be the witnesses. Take these men, go there, strike this rock, water's going to come out of it. And it's going to be sufficient water for you and all of Israel, all of your flocks and everything that you need. It's all going to come forth. And once again, God says, I'm going to show you again my power. How many times in the course of this book have we seen God act in a miraculous way? You want to start counting? I mean, it's been dozens of times. So once again, God has to come to these people and he has to provide for them a flow of rock to show his power, to show his work, something that they have consistently forgotten. Now, I had you compare this chapter, Numbers 20. Moses, by the way, rewrites some of this history in the book of Numbers in order to, once again, fit it into context. And in Numbers chapter 20, there are a number of similarities in the story there. This is a different event in Numbers 20 than what you see here, okay? It appears in the text, if you compare 20 verse 1 to the beginning of chapter 17, that they're in a similar location. Sin and Zin are synonyms for each other in Hebrew. In both cases, the people are in need of water. Okay, once again, they're in a desolate place, so they need water. Third, in both cases, once again, the people complain. Now, the incident in Numbers 20 is much later, but they're still whining, they're still complaining about the same thing. And in both cases, Moses strikes the rock. Now, remember we talked about last week, we speculated about the idea that Moses may have struck the rock in the second incident out of sheer habit. I mean, it's after all, it's the last time. This is what God told him to do, Exodus 17. So it's very possible that Moses just thought, like, well, I'll just go and do it again. But God had specifically instructed him not to do that. He is told to speak to the rock. And I would argue that the difference is significant because this event in Exodus 17 is prior to the giving of the law, and the events in Numbers 20 is after the giving of the law, in which, in the giving of the law, once again, God has spoken. He has spoken. He has given forth his law. And so he has given, by virtue of his voice, that which comes upon Israel as their governing force. The law becomes their governing force. But it's a word from God. Okay, you could make the very good argument, if this book were written in Greek, it was written in Hebrew, if it were written in Greek, that Moses could say that law was theanoustos, breathed out by God, because it was. Okay, so the difference, I think, is that in this particular case, the people do not yet have the law. Okay, so God's okay with physical signs at this point. But once the law is given, God says, I've spoken. Therefore, from now on, all of my power is going to come through the word. It's not going to come through you striking something. It's going to come from you trusting the word that I have given to you. In some ways, it's very similar, I would say, to the connection between what it means to come by faith versus what it means to come to God by faith versus what it means to come to God with all of your religiosity. You come before God trusting a word, or you come before God trusting an action. And which one does God accept? You come before God trusting a word, because he has said, just believe me, and I will give you life. You can't come and strike the rock. You must come and believe the word. That's, I think, the difference. So this is prior to the giving of the law, and God allows him to strike the rock here, and he's doing so, again, to make a connection to the striking the Nile during the early days of the plagues. And so he's making a point. I'm going to bring power. But eventually my power is going to be simply my word, what I'm going to say, as it's going to come to you. So you need to, in that day, you will need to trust me. And that's the reason why Moses is not granted access to the promised land. I suspect that there's more to it than meets the eye. Maybe that Moses simply did not understand that, or that Moses himself knew it and failed to obey it. Either way, God says, you're not going in. I want this to be a sign. I want this to be so important that the people know this. I'm not going to allow you into the promised land, Moses, in order to make this point.
I was listening to Sproul, Sproul or MacArthur talk about that. He mentioned that one of the reasons maybe Moses wasn't allowed in was also because he struck the rock in anger.
And that's another, that's part of it, yes. Mm-hmm. I agree with that. So, in verse 8, now, comes in, the second half of the chapter, comes another obstacle that the people face. Okay. And as we've said before, these are not obstacles that God has not purposed along the way. They're designed. Okay. So, the people coming to the sea and being trapped at the sea with Pharaoh behind them, that's an obstacle God had purposed. Coming to a place where there's no food, an obstacle God purposed. No water, an obstacle God purposes. Now another one that God has purposed. I mean, look, does God know that the Amalekites live in this area? Of course he does. Does he think that leading 2 million Hebrews through the wilderness is not going to cause the Amalekites to freak out? He knows that. Okay, he's purposing these things, okay? So when we see this, we need to understand this is, again, another thing that God is allowing to surface at this point for a reason. So it's the Amalekites that come and fight against the Hebrews. Now, you remember that the Amalekites descend from Amalek, who is a grandson of Esau. So he comes from the other line of Isaac, the two sons of Isaac. So this is on the other side of that equation. You can go see that in Genesis 36:12 and 1 Chronicles 1:36. They are a nomadic people who live in the south of Palestine. We'll talk more about that in a second. But they come south and attack the Hebrews in the Sinai Peninsula. More than likely, they make this attack because they see this large group of Hebrews and all of the other peoples that are with them as a threat. Makes perfect sense. A threat to their territory. And because of the rumors that have come out of Egypt regarding their way of escape, the power of God demonstrated there, right? So it's possible that God has allowed the Amalekites to come and to strike for some reasons. Number one, it's part of the normal course of events. Okay? Remember, there's a lot of times when God is going to use what we would call in theological circles a secondary means. This is a secondary means which God will use to bring glory to himself. Right? The Amalekites coming, making a decision on their own to come and attack these Hebrews is a secondary means. So God has allowed them to come even though he has purposed for them to come. That becomes a secondary means. Okay? In other words, it's the normal course of events. There's no special significance to it. Other than the nation, the Amalekites are protecting themselves or believe that they need to protect themselves against this horde. Second, of course, if this is ordained by God, it is designed to strengthen the Hebrews by giving them an initial people to fight so that they can learn how to fight. We talked about this last week, remember? These are people who have for 400 years been serving as slaves in Egypt. They have not been serving as part of a militaristic force. If they left Egypt with weapons, they may not know exactly how to use them, particularly against a people who are familiar with the territory. The Amalekites would have been very familiar with the turf. And so they're fighting on their own land, if you will. So they're quite familiar with how to deal with this. This horde of Hebrews is not going to necessarily have the ability to do so. Plus the fact that, let's not forget, this isn't just men. This is men and women and children and herds of flocks and everything else that they've been carting along with them going there. They're not in a situation where they're really prepared to fight. They don't have that necessarily. So it's very possible, seems reasonable to me anyways, that God designed this in order for the Hebrews to get their first taste of military conquest, but for God to show them, listen, you can have some, you will have power here. Now, the Amalekites were not a big people, okay, so we're not talking about millions coming over the hills to attack the Hebrews, okay? We're probably talking about small guerrilla forces that are attacking the Hebrews, but they're very effective in what they know how to do this, they know how to fight, especially in the desert. And so God is going to give them an opportunity here to fight a small enemy, have victory over that enemy, and it'll do a couple of things. It will show them how to fight as a ragtag group of people, but it also gives them some confidence when not too far down the road they actually have to encounter a real enemy, especially as they have to go into Canaan and start dislodging some people from their own locations. And by the way, fighting the Edomites, the descendants of Esau, in the valley beyond the Jordan, I mean beyond the Dead Sea, ain't going to be easy because they live up in the caves, in the hills, and they have easy ambush capabilities in there. So this is going to be a first taste, if you will. This is going to be a first taste of what God is going to do to sort of get them prepared for what is to come. I mean, it's a normal course of events that he's going to use. By the way, I think this is what Moses speaks about back in chapter 15. Remember the great song that he sang, right? The peoples have heard and they tremble. Pangs have seized the inhabitants of Philistia. Now are the chiefs of Edom dismayed. Trembling seizes the leaders of Moab. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. It's kind of like a prediction of what's coming. Yeah, they're going to be afraid, but they're not going to go down without a fight. And so here's an example of them coming. Now, these Amalekites, as I said, are a nomadic people group, and they occupy wilderness territory in what would be called the Negev. In many Bible translations, it has a B instead of a V on the end of it, Negev. Today, it's the Negev with a V. Basically, that's the territory to the west of the Dead Sea, to the Mediterranean. It's actually a fairly thin swath of land from about the southeast corner of the Mediterranean across to the Dead Sea. Eventually, the tribe of Judah will occupy this territory. It will be at the border between Benjamin and Judah and then the 10 northern tribes. So draw an imaginary line from the top of the Dead Sea directly west to the Mediterranean, and you'd find the top of the Negev. And then the Negev just gets more and more and more arid as you go south. Okay, so they probably occupied territory in the south of the territory of Judah eventually. The Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites dwell in the hill country, which you remember from our geography lessons of Israel. There are four major zones to Palestine. You've got the plain zone to the east of the Mediterranean where the Philistines live. Then you move into the hill country, which is a spine running north and south through the middle of Palestine. Then you come down into the Jordan Valley, and then you have the Transjordan to the other side of the Jordan, which is, the arid desert area in that direction. The Hittites, Jebusites, and Amorites are dwelling in the central hill country. And this will become the primary territory of the Hebrews after the conquest. During the conquest, during the days of Joshua, they will be limited to a large extent to that central spine. They'll fan out, but the bulk of the peoples will wind up in that central territory. So all of these nations, the Amorites, the Jebusites, the Hittites, the Amalekites, all of those peoples will be central in the conquest because they're all going to be a part of what the Israelites are going to have to dislodge in order for them to take that particular land. So it tells us that Joshua is told, choose men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. It's Moses speaking. So Joshua did as Moses told him, and he fought with Amalek while Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. Whenever Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed, and whenever he lowered his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands grew weary, so they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it while Aaron and Hur held up his hands, one on one side, one on the other. So his hands were steady until the going down of the sun, and Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the sword. Now notice that's only about a day's worth of fighting. One would argue probably a half a day's worth of fighting. So basically midday until sundown is probably when they're doing this. Everything gets started in the morning, and then they'll start the battle about midday until the end of the day. It says that Moses is holding his hands up. Okay, and this has always puzzled people. It's puzzled me. You know, why is it that the Israelites prevail while Moses had his hands up, but when his hands go down, suddenly there's some sort of, you know, the fighting turns? And by the way, who gets to judge that? How exactly does that work? How do you know that one's prevailing over the other on a particular thing? I mean, you got a whole bunch of people down in the valley swinging swords at each other. How do you know one's prevailing over the other in a certain situation? Well, Moses apparently knows, because he writes this in this way. So there's a number of suggestions. First, maybe the Israelites, looking at Moses' hands, see them as some sort of rally cry or some sort of morale booster, and so they're able to muster up the energy and fighting skills necessary to win whenever they see the motivation of Moses' hands held up. And they look up and they see him up there with his hands up and they charge into the fight. It's kind of like the last scene of Braveheart. Familiar with that scene? Right, okay. So the idea is that they, you know, they're rallied to it because they see something. That's a possibility. Maybe there's nothing supernatural about this at all. Maybe it's simply human morale that's taking place. Another suggestion, and one that I don't necessarily disagree with either, is that somehow, through Moses holding up his hands, the power of God flowed through the Israelites whenever he lifted up his hands in accordance with God's implied instructions. So maybe in some way, God provided some sort of supernatural ability for Moses whenever he had his hands up so that the people could fight stronger. It doesn't really say. It could be either way. It doesn't really say. Either way, what we do know that comes out in the end is they do defeat the Amalekites. More than likely, what they probably do is they kill many of them and the rest are driven back because the Amalekites are not finished. We're going to see them again at some point in the future. So the attacking force that comes is routed and flees. And the Israelites succeed at their first real militaristic conquest. And by the way, there's another possibility of why it is that God does this. It could be some training opportunity for Joshua. Opportunity for Joshua to figure out how to lead men in this kind of situation. Because again, he's not trained in this. He might have had some sort of training in Egypt that would help him, but we don't know what that would be. Nonetheless, they do have some sort of victory here, okay? And they are to record it as a memorial. You'll notice in verse 14, write this as a memorial in a book and recite it in the ears of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under the sun. Okay, so God comes to Moses and says, I want you to write this down, okay? It needs to be recorded as Israel's first great military victory. You'd want to write that down, don't you think? If you had your first great military victory, sounds like something you want to write down. Let's not forget the fact that we beat these Amalekites down, even though we aren't very good militaristically, but by golly, we had success here, okay? Secondly, Joshua needed to know that this was part of the overarching plan of God into the future. Notice it says, recite it in the ears of Joshua. Why? Joshua was down on the battlefield, wasn't he? Or was he not? Seems like he would be, because after all, it says up in verse 9, Moses said to Joshua, choose for us men and go out and fight with Amalek. So it seems that Joshua was down in the battlefield. So he already knew of all of what took place, right? He was in the middle of it. Why then a recitation of it to his ears? Because he's going to become the leader of Israel when Moses is gone, and he's going to become a militaristic leader. This is probably a way of God speaking into Joshua's ear and saying, listen, you need to understand, the reason you won this is not because you're good, but because I, God, have given you the power to win. You need to be reminded of this. This event is not designed to show you how good you are militaristically, because look, you aren't. You came out of Egypt with no training in this. The reason that you were able to beat off these highly trained and highly motivated nomadic peoples is because I gave you the victory. In this, shall we say, rather bizarre way of holding up Moses' hands and you had victory. In other words, say it in Joshua's ear so that Joshua in the future hears that ringing in his ear. The next time we encounter the Amalekites or when we encounter the other Canaanites, we will trust the power of God. Write it down as a memorial, as a remembrance of these things. And think about it. This is one of the strongest reasons that was given during the days of the Reformation when Zwingli stood before Luther and said, "You haven't taken the Reformation far enough. Justification is by faith, yes. But when it comes to the Lord's Supper, it isn't a means of grace. It's a memorial. It's a reminder of what Christ has done. You are still taking it the way the Catholics teach it." So Zwingli and Luther disagreed on this point. And that's why we, out of the Baptist tradition, look to Zwingli and others like him and say, we don't take the Lord's Supper as a means of grace. We don't see it that way in the New Testament. We see it as a memorial, as a reminder of what someone else did. Because the problem with taking it as a means of grace is you begin to think, I take the Lord's Supper, thus I bring the power of God into my life and it brings something to bear in me. And Zwingli said to Luther, you can't do that because you believe in justification by faith alone. Therefore, the supper has to be a memorial alone. I mean, even Jesus said it that way, right? Do this in remembrance of me, not of you. So it's a memorial. That's, I think, the same kind of thing going on here. This is something God has done, and I want you to shout it into the ear of Joshua so that he remembers it. So every time that he comes to an enemy, he looks across the valley at the enemy and he says, we are not going to have victory over this enemy. God is going to have victory over this enemy. And then I think a third reason why this is a memorial is because of this statement. I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Write it down. Write it down. I'm going to blot these people out of their existence. Now, by the way, we've talked about this a number of times, but I just want to, here's a pretty good place to once again bring up the subject. This is an act on the part of God of genocide. Destroying a people, right? Now, there are many who will argue against the Bible by saying, well, your God is genocidal, therefore I can't believe in your God. But the response back to that would be, who were these people? And why were they blotted out? Why is it that God utterly destroyed them from the face of the earth? Did they deserve to live in the first place? Did they ever have, at any time, an absolute right to exist? The answer, of course, is no. But they are also a people that are dangerous, as were so many of the other Canaanite peoples. They were peoples who had religious they had religious practices which are dangerous to the human race. Human sacrifice is dangerous to the human race. I mean, whole peoples have gone extinct from the face of the earth because they practice human sacrifice. I mean, there are tribes in South America that disappeared from the face of the earth because, and we've been able to demonstrate it effectively, because they sacrificed themselves. They killed themselves off. Their birth rate dropped so far because they were killing off their own children, they couldn't survive. And then all it took was one small warring tribe to come up against them and kill them off. They're dangerous to the human race. They're full of sin because they have rejected God and have been given plenty of opportunity to follow God. They've rejected him and continue to do what is dangerous to the race, therefore they must be eliminated. And they never had a right to exist in the first place. That, by the way, we need to always be able to explain that to someone who wants to attack the Bible in that way. You need to be able to explain it.
When Saul was told to go kill all of them,
yep,
and he didn't.
Right.
And he saved the king, of course, Samuel took care of him.
Right.
But why was he supposed to kill all the animals? He's supposed to wipe out everything.
Well, what God told him was, dedicate it all to me. Give it all to me. It's all mine. I want you to give it all to me. I don't want you Israelites to keep a single thing from those people. I want their memory blotted out from the face of the earth. Kill off everything and destroy everything that had anything to do with them. Some Israelite that decided to take a few sheep out of their flock and keep them for himself, he'll walk over to his neighbor and go, I got those sheep from the Amorites. No, God says, I want their name blotted out of heaven. I don't want anybody or anything associated with them to exist on this planet anymore. They're gone. That's why. And he failed to obey that. He didn't need any of that stuff in the first place.
He was king.
Right. And besides, he had everything he needed. God had given him everything he needed. So God has promised to mark these people out for destruction. And so this small little military battle begins the process of the Amalekites eventually being destroyed. In 1 Samuel 15, the story that you just mentioned, God had promised after the Amalekites had ambushed the Israelites coming out of Egypt that he would wipe them out. That did not come to fruition during the conquest, as the Amalekites were able to survive with some allies. If you go to Judges 6:3 and 33 and 7:12, they exist all the way up to the time of Saul. So they continue to be a problem for a long time. You could argue that God gave these people the mercy to live for another, let's see, 400 years? No, a little less than that, 300 years? David took the reins in 1010 BC. Saul probably said, well, yeah, almost 400 years. Conquest in 1400. Saul right around 1000 and probably 1100, earlier than that even. So you're looking at 400 years roughly. So he allows them to live for another 400 years before he finally has them destroyed. God could have had them destroyed anywhere along the way, but he allowed them to continue, part of his mercy over them. But once he had used them for his final purposes, he instructs Saul to wipe them out, a command that Saul did not obey. It would appear that the national identity of a people known as the Amalekites did not disappear then until even after David, because we still find them in 2 Samuel 8. They're a sticky people, but they don't exist now.
My note says that they were finally destroyed in Persia at the time of Esther and Mordecai.
I'm not sure where they get that from.
473 B.C. Yep. Esther 2, 5.
Well, okay, there may have been more even from that point, yeah. I didn't remember that reference, but that's possible. In any case, the point being, they survived quite a long ways before they were eventually and wiped out. It may have taken hundreds of years for God's promise to come to fulfillment, but that didn't take too long. I mean, that did take place. But they eventually did get wiped out.
But even, you know, I would think that God knows how sin,
sure,
you know, just kind of blossoms,
right,
just a little bit.
Correct.
And that's the Amalekite sin. I mean, they're already dealing with their own sin. I mean, and you add that in there. Just
absolutely.
An influence in that, and that's just going to corrupt everything.
Which, correct.
You know,
a little leaven goes a long ways in the loaf, right? And that's exactly the problem. The Israelites kept embracing the various cultic practices of the people around them. Saul, you know, even taking some of those things from them produced some sort of effect, lasting effect, killed his reign, plus all of the other Canaanites that they embraced in all the ways. And I mean, even get to Solomon. I mean, how did Solomon wind up being such a poor king in the end? Because he surrounded himself with paganism. He married 700 foreign women and brought all of their worship into his household. I mean, you wonder why his son Rehoboam was an idiot. It's because his dad was.
I said he had two birthday parties every day.
Yeah. Now, we go to chapter 18. Okay. Chapter 18, the whole of the chapter deals with just one particular incident, and that's Jethro coming out to see the people and the interaction between Jethro and Moses. Now, Jethro, of course, is Moses' father-in-law. Moses has spent a good deal of time with Jethro. You remember that Moses was 40 years old when he was driven out of Egypt, and he was 80 years old when he returned for the Exodus. So he spent 40 years out in the wilderness after being run out of Egypt. So he has spent 40 years with this man, or, you know, close to that, you know, rounding it off. So he knows Jethro. Jethro is a Midianite. The Midianites were descended from Ishmael, the other side of the Abrahamic family line. But they were worshipers of God. Okay, they knew the one true God. Again, they did not have any direct revelation from God, as the Israelites did. The family of Jacob did not. But they did worship God, and they did recognize where the holy mountain was, living in the wilderness of Sinai. They knew where God's holy mountain was. Jethro undoubtedly was aware of the territory that the Israelites had come. And so he is, at this time, at the beginning of chapter 18, he has Moses' wife and children with him. Because you remember, they were driven out of Egypt, sent out of Egypt, to sent back to Jethro in order to protect them from Pharaoh's edict. And so Jethro has been hanging on to them, taking care of them for Moses, and rightly so. But now, Jethro is curious. The only explanation I can get as to why he comes out is he's curious. He had heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel's people, how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. So Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, had taken Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he'd sent her home, along with her two sons, gives their names, and comes out to Moses with his sons and his wife in the wilderness when he was encamped in the mountain. The only motivation that I can come up with is just flat-out curiosity. And there's other possibilities. Maybe he wanted to get rid of these daughter and kids. Tried to get them out of the house once. Now I got them back again. I doubt it. That's not the culture of the time. You know, the culture of the time, you know, a Semitic people's culture would have been very welcoming. And so there's no reason for Jethro to want to get rid of his daughters and grandsons. In fact, it would have been a great honor for him to raise his grandsons in place of his father. That would have been an honor in Semitic tribes. So that's not likely. So I'm inclined to say he just was curious. What's going on? How did you come out here? What's been going on? I heard about this. I'd like to come out and have you tell me about it. So he goes. He takes the wife and kids, and he goes out and brings them out there. And so he brings the family back together again. And so they sit down, and they chat, and they talk about it. And so it says in verse 7, he went out to meet him and bowed down and kissed him, and they asked each other of their welfare and went into the tent. And Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, all the hardship that had come upon them in the way and how the Lord had delivered them. And Jethro rejoiced for all the good that the Lord had done to Israel and that he had delivered him out of the hand of the Egyptians. So they had a nice conversation. They talked about it. Everything has happened. This is all the stuff that happened to us along the way. Probably told him about all the plagues. Probably told him about the Red Sea, you know, crossing over, and all the dead Egyptians washing up on the shore, and then getting to a place where there's no food, and so God sends manna. Oh, and by the way, in the morning I'll show you what that looks like. And water from a rock, and the Amalekites coming against us. And we don't know how to fight Amalekites, but hey, we had victory over them. All I had to do was hold my hands up, and they won. It's an amazing story if you think about it. And we've only been three chapters since the Exodus, and there's all this to tell. So Jethro comes out and he hears all this story. But one of the other things that he discovers is that Moses has been acting as the judge over Israel. He's been asking as the judge. Notice verse 13. The next day Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood around Moses from morning till evening. Now, a judge in this context isn't just what we think of a judge today as someone who adjudicates judicial issues. Judges had far greater responsibility than that. They were, and by the way, the book of Judges is named after this particular role, okay? The idea of leadership in which you are governing all of the various civil realities of the life of a people. You're governing over the people in the sense of helping them to deal with the kinds of normal human issues that would come up. Now, let's not forget, at this particular point, even at this particular point, Israel is a theocracy, right? You know what a theocracy is, right? It's a government headed by God. Okay, a monarchy is a government headed by a monarch, a king, right? A democracy is one supposedly headed by the people. We are in a republic, which is a representative form of democracy, okay? And then you've got dictatorships, which are run by despots and so forth, okay? So, but a theocracy is a government in which there is no set individual leading over the nation, but the responsibility of leading is filtered down through individuals. And in this particular case, because Israel has not been formed well yet, we haven't taken the various tribes and turned them into specific geographical places and made sure that the various heads of each of the clans and each of the tribes are doing their job, Moses has stepped up to fill the void. And what he has stepped up to do, basically, is to handle all the disputes that have arisen between the people. When you get to the book of Judges, by the way, you get the same kind of thing. You get all the various judges, and they continue to act in their role as leaders over the people, but they're not kings. Remember, you get to the end of the book of Judges, and what do the people do then? We want a king, okay? We're sick of this, you know, theoretical king that we have over us called God. We want a real king because all the other nations have one, and we want one too. So there's this sense in which Moses has stepped up to act sort of as a dispute handler. I don't know whatever else it would be. It's not a judge in the judicial sense. I'm sure that Moses was adjudicating crimes along the way, no doubt. But remember, there's no law given yet. So it's hard to adjudicate crimes when there isn't any established law. So in essence, what Moses has to do is he has to deal with people in the best way he knows how. So some guy's sheep starts eating another guy's grass. They don't know anything yet. But one guy claims to own this particular little spot, another guy runs his sheep through, and the first guy says, you know, you trampled on my stuff, and this should be my spot, and there's no law, there's no boundary lines, there's none of that sort of thing. So Moses has to somewhat just stand there and try to figure it out all day long in the various disputes. And based on the way that text reads, the fact that he stood around from, then the people stood around Moses from morning till evening, certainly implies there were a lot of them.
People.
You got a lot of people in a very small place with not a lot, and goats and sheep and everything else imaginable wandering around, and the people all running into each other all over the place. Not to mention that clan over there has a son that wants to marry that girl in that clan over there, and we don't know what to do about that. I don't know if it's possible. Or I've decided to hook up my daughter with this guy's son over here, and he was supposed to pay me X, and I didn't get X from him, and now I, you know. So just try to put yourself in that situation. How many disputes come up, right? Okay. You get the picture. That's, by the way, that's what the picture you need to paint here as you look at this. Because the verse is kind of thin. It doesn't really tell us much. So you have to step back from the text and go, what's the meta-narrative here? Hey, that's a word I used this morning. What's the meta-narrative? What's the larger story here? There's obviously much more going on than meets the eye. Okay. And so Jethro comes and goes, what is that you're doing for the people? Why do you sit alone, all the people standing around you from morning till night? Now, what's the question? Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? And Moses says, because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a dispute, they come to me and I decide between one person and another, and I make them know the statutes of God and his laws. Now, that's anachronistic. There are no laws yet, okay? So the statutes and laws that Moses is referring to here is not the Ten Commandments and beyond, which doesn't come yet for another chapter. So when he says statutes and laws, what does he mean? He means just common sense. Okay, what's built into the human person is just common sense, right? You don't hit your neighbor over the head with a rock and take a sheep. You don't need a law to tell you not to do that, okay? That's just part of the Imago Dei. That's just part of the image of God in us. Okay, so the statutes and laws here are just those precepts of life that ought to be normal. The kinds of things that sinful human beings have a really hard time remembering.
But wouldn't you think the way they've crumbled before, that they would have come up with this themselves and said, hey, Moses, I'm tired of standing out here in this hot sun all day. Why don't you get somebody
here? Ah,
you can get us.
But there's the, thank you for going there, because that's the implication of Jethro's question.
Yeah, why are you doing
it? Why are you doing it? And the answer is because Moses hasn't delegated this like he should have. That's the whole point. Jethro's coming to him and saying, this thing is too heavy for you. You are not able to do it alone. Why are you even trying to do this alone? Look, Moses is a guy just like any of us. Right? And sometimes, what's our reaction to delegating things? Well, it's just easier for me to do it myself. Right? Now, why did you point to him? I don't know. Why did you just do it ourselves?
He told me that about moving chairs.
Yeah.
It was not long ago.
Yeah. Do it myself. Right. That's our natural inclination. So Moses says, I'd just rather do this myself. I don't know if I can trust these guys or not, so I'm just going to do this. And Jethro goes, you don't understand what you're doing here. You are, first of all, you're burning yourself out. But what's implied in here is you are not doing what you're supposed to be doing because you're cluttering up your life with the things you are doing. Okay, he says, obey my voice, I will give you advice, and God be with you. You shall represent the people before God and bring their cases to God, and you shall warn them about the statutes and the laws and make them know the way in which they must walk and what they must do. Look for able men from all the people, men who fear God and are trustworthy and hate a bribe, and place such men over the people as chiefs of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens, and let them judge the people at all times. Every great matter they shall bring to you, but any small matter they shall decide themselves. What's his point? Moses, you have a job. Your job is not to deal with individual little things that are going on amongst these 2 million people. Your job is to be there in the face of God, and God you're to speak with God. You're to be the one who will teach the people the general statutes of God and the general ways of God. Your job is to lead the people in the understanding of the things of God. All these mundane things can be taken care of by others. Ah, exactly my point.
But now we know why his father-in-law is there.
Now we know why his father-in-law is there, exactly. He's a wiser guy than Moses. The fact is that's exactly the point. Let's go back to it, right? What's going on in the book of Acts? The apostles are taking care of everything. All the disputes that come up, all the Greek widows that aren't getting enough food because the Hebrew widows are being given all the best spots because, well, after all, it's a largely Jewish crowd, so the Hebrew widows are going to get more than the Greek widows. And so the Greeks come and complain, and so the apostles go, you know what? You know what? Hey, we're out of it. Here's what we're going to do. Congregation, you appoint men that you trust, all right? And we will set them aside to this task, and we will focus our attention on what we're supposed to be doing, okay? We'll focus our sense on what we're supposed to be doing, which is prayer and teaching. That's what we're supposed to be doing. You guys can handle the mundane stuff, okay? That's just wise. It took them 6 chapters of the book to figure it out, but they figured it out. They realized this is what we need to do. And that became the structure, the proper structure of the church through time, or what it should be in the New Testament, right? A group of elders that are leading the church in its spiritual growth, focusing on that which is really important in terms of spiritual life, and delegating to qualified, gifted, and passionate men to do this other more mundane stuff. Doesn't mean that the mundane stuff's not important. Clearly it is. To those who are involved in the disputes, it's important stuff. So it takes men that are trustworthy. That's why Jethro says, find trustworthy men. Find men, even, he says, that hate a bribe. Okay? Because what's going to be the natural inclination here? I'll give you a goat if you'll send it my way, right? Okay? Find men that hate a bribe, that are good judges, and delegate it to them and trust them to do this, and you go and interface with God and you teach the people what God's rules and statutes and laws are. You teach the overarching spiritual principles, and these other men will take care of this mundane stuff. And you will not burn yourself out in the process. I can assure you, this is an absolute fact. It's not open for discussion. It's an absolute fact. The vast majority of pastors in America burn out because they don't get this principle right here.
And why not, you think?
Because two reasons. Fear. Two reasons. Number one, because they themselves have not really understood how this is to be done, and secondly, many churches demand it from him in that way. In the vast majority, especially of churches that are single staff, and listen, the vast majority of churches in America are single staff churches. They have a pastor and maybe a deacon or two to go with it. All the work falls upon the pastor. All of it. It's his job to do everything. Anything fails, it falls on his back. They don't understand what that means. And that is why in the Baptist church in America, pastors burn out in 5 years. And they're gone. Because they just can't do all the work. They just cannot do everything that needs to be done. Now, again, it's two faults. It's the fault of the men who allow it to happen, but it's also the fault of the churches that insist on it in their congregations. And they don't understand the biblical picture that's being painted here. And they especially don't understand the New Testament picture of elders and deacons. The pastor that was in here today from Arkansas made this. I asked him, do you have an elder-based model in your church? And he says, well, he says, no. He says, the reason why is because if I call them elders, I'm not welcome in the Arkansas Baptist Association. I can't join the Arkansas Baptist Association. They won't let me join if we call them elders. So I call them deacons and treat them like elders. I said to him, my response to him is, I would have told the Arkansas Baptist Association to stick it. You need me more than I need you. That's what I would have said. Whether he's going to do that or not, I don't know. But he's working in that direction. The model here that is painted is the model of trust men, delegate the responsibility to them, and let them do it so that you, Moses, can focus on what is important, to stay focused on that which is critical. Because all this other stuff is not all that critical. It's easily taken care of with some wise men that can deal with it. And if you spread it out amongst all the clan leaders and tribal leaders that are out there, these kinds of issues will not take up much time in the life of the people. You'll have peace in the camp. And I think another reason is, as soon as Moses would have made a serious judicial mistake somewhere along the way, it would have been a problem. And Jethro knew it. So he said, don't get yourself into that situation. Look, as we come to the end of chapter 18, and I think this is, by the way, the reason why Moses spends the entire chapter on it. Notice he puts so much word into this. He learned the lesson. Remember who wrote the book? So he includes it. He's including it to say, I am the guy who learned this lesson, okay? And it's here because when you get to chapter 19 and then into 20, you see Moses having to become the primary spokesman for God to the people. He's the one that's got to bring the law. He's the one that's got to bring the ceremonial system into place. He's the one who's got to make sure that the people are living according to what God has commanded them to live. And so he's got a much greater responsibility than dealing with whose sheep is living on whose grazing lands. He's got much bigger fish to fry. To that end, then, I decided that I really wanted to put a lesson in chapter 19 by itself. And that's why you'll notice your questions for next week are just on chapter 19. And I called it Israel Camps at Sinai because there's enough there to actually consider before we start looking into chapter 20, which begins the giving of the law. So, two lessons we've seen on Israel traveling to Sinai. Now we'll have one more on Israel camping at Sinai and all of what's in chapter 19. And the lesson's a little easier than it typically is because it's only a single chapter, but it's I think it's an important chapter. I don't want you to overlook it, if you will, by going through it. Now, just a note of housekeeping here. Lord willing, we should be together next Sunday. My daughter is expecting the child. She's scheduled on the 16th, and Grandma wants to be there, of course, when daughter gives birth. So we're planning to be there in Florida on the 16th. So we should be here next Sunday if all goes according to plan. However, if something should go wrong, of course, we may not. So we will not be here on the 18th, 2 weeks from today. So we will do the questions for this next lesson next week, and then we'll skip over a week and we'll come back for the lecture the week to follow, okay? So So we will hopefully get to the questions next week, okay? And then we'll do the lessons, and then we'll skip another week because we'll have Labor Day weekend coming after that. So we'll be bouncing every other week for a while. So.
And all that's on the calendar.
And all that's on the calendar, that's correct. So thanks for the plug, David. Yep. If you can get to it, yes.